Okay, to begin, my name is Curtis Childs. It's August 7th, 2015. We're here in Fryeburg, Maine, and I'm giving a talk, but I gotta look at what the title is on my notes. If we believe the way things really are, the details of how heaven and hell show up in our thoughts and feelings. So that's the name of the talk, and from that title, it might sound like I know the details of how heaven and hell show up in the in thoughts and feelings, but I don't. But I have some general trajectory. Like, oh, I think this might be part of the way towards understanding that. So I want to try to give you guys all the tools that I have, and you can move forward from there and complete the task. The basic premise is, I'm wondering, is life harder than it needs to be? I think that we're never going to have a life where there's no suffering at all, but is there suffering that can be alleviated? You know, I think about, you know, obviously we're not going to live forever, but there were diseases that at one time were just causing all kinds of problems, but now they're not around anymore. Are there similar things that people suffer from in the heart and mind that we can make progress on? And can we do that through some of the insights that Swedenborg gained? So I'm going to begin by reading some Swedenborg, so hold on to your hats. And this is from Arcana Celestia, or Secrets of Heaven. It's the old translation, 6206. And this is where the title came from, If We Believe the Way Things Really Are. Because it's that, you'll hear that phrase in this quote, and you would think that's what you should do, right? You should believe the way things really are. It would seem like that's the right direction to move in. And it seems as though here, Swedenborg is saying, if we had our information straight, we'd be in much better shape. So that's where we're going to begin. To take the subject further, so we're jumping right in the middle of something, it should be recognized that all evil flows in from hell, and all good from the Lord by way of heaven. The reason, however, why evil becomes a person's own is that he believes and convinces himself, and he thinks and practices it all by himself. In this way, he makes it his own. But if he believed what is really so, that's my title, it would not be evil but good from the Lord that became his own. For if he believed what is really so, he would think the instant evil flowed in that it came from the evil spirits present with him. And since that was what he thought, the angels could ward that off and repel it. For influx from angels takes place into what a person knows and believes, not into what he doesn't know or believe. There is nowhere else for it to become firmly established than in something the person knows or believes. So there's a lot in there. And if we're just going to think about it psychologically, that there are negative things that come in, and if we had a certain opinion about the origin of those, they would be easier to dissipate, right? Isn't that's what he's saying. There's sort of this ultimate goal, I feel like, of perception, and that being like a Swedenborgian phrase that means you know what your thoughts and feelings are, like where they come from. You know, we can know very well the external messages that we get. What are they? You know, is this someone trying to scam me? Like, my wife just got an email recently from Curtis Childs, but it's a different email address, but it's my name on it. Because somebody, like, knows her contact list and knew. You've seen those kind of scams, right? We know that that's not real. If we could have the same kind of identification of thoughts and feelings, where would that take us? And that here he's saying that if you could, and this is going to start abstract, and it's going to get practical, so don't worry about it. If you knew that, hey, this stuff that's coming in isn't mine, then it can be dissipated. And I was just, that somehow that knowledge makes it easier to dislodge things. So let's move forward. All good is from heaven, all evil is from hell. I don't know, sounds like a pretty religious thing. But, you know, it's a different view of the mind. We sort of walk around and have this view that, hey, I'm in my life and it's sort of a jumble. You know, that it's there's like, okay, things are going well. Oh, I was giving a talk at Freiburg. Oh, I said this thing wrong. Now nobody likes me. What am I going to do? You know, this sort of this mishmash of positive and negative. There's this other model that there's actually these two polarities and that they're kind of meeting in the middle and that there's this force, there's God who wants to make us happy. And then there's love of self or hell that is trying to pull us in the other direction. Okay? So what I would like to do is figure out how do I go for the good stuff, right? But that doesn't seem very easy because it seems very difficult to pick out. Because it's not that simple as you can sort of get this. There's an angel and a devil, and you know, oh, I really want to eat 3 pieces of cake, but I should eat 2. Is this the struggle? But that's not what life is like, is it? Life is this complex swirl of like relationships and emotions and events, and it's not all black and white. You know, it's not all morally clear, right? Like, well, the only struggle is I want to do something bad, but I shouldn't. It's not like that. There are doubts we have about ourselves. There are doubts that we have about how life is going to turn out. There are fears. There are wounding experiences that we have. There are very morally gray areas, all these kinds of things. So how do you sort that out? I don't know, but I'm going to give you some of my best guesses. I found that even though I've read Swedenborg, like I don't think I know where everything's coming from. And I don't ever think I can know the specifics about a particular thing. Like let's say that I am feeling a certain amount of fear around a particular issue. I can never know, is that false or true, like for me to be feeling that. I can just create reasonable doubt. You know, I don't have Swedenborg had this thing, this perception where when he got a thought or a feeling, he could know the source, know whether it was true or false. Would that be handy? I mean, because there's a big difference. Externally, it's an obvious thing that makes sense. There's, you know, if you were surrounded by a group of people and some of them are supporting you and encouraging you and some of them are tearing you down or saying negative things about you, if you learned, oh, these people are saying negative things, actually, they want my job, then it's suddenly like, oh, that stuff wasn't true. They're saying it for that reason. That understanding the source of it matters a lot, you know? Or if you see some kind of ad and it's like sponsored by the committee for this, you know, oh, this is why they're doing it. And that affects how you take it. So if we could have that about the thoughts and feelings that we have in us, that would be a nice boost, because I've found that a lot of life is this, you're getting pushed in these sort of circles of emotion and you don't quite know the way forward. So, because Swedenborg says all good is from heaven, all evil is from hell, but what's good and what's evil? And where does that show up in the mind? So the best way that I can think to get at that is to think about what is hell like and what is heaven like. You've got a field that you own, and there's a bunch of people that came, and they're partying on it. And you're like, okay, all right, show me your IDs or whatever. Nobody has IDs, but you can sort of guess where they came from. Right? It's a terrible analogy, but this is just we're just looking at things like, oh yeah, this general characteristics. So for my first specific, Swedenborg says that the root of hell or the hell mindset is love of dominion, love of self. So I generally, that's my first dividing point, is are these thoughts and feelings, this particular issue, even if I can't know it, is it trying to dominate? You know, how much is it trying to control me? You know, because all thoughts and feelings claim they're there to help you. You know, it's like, yeah, I'm making you feel miserable about something you did, but that's just so that you'll be a good person, or that's so you'll get the issue fixed, right? Isn't that, that's the claim. So everybody says, I'm supposed to be here. We're all from heaven. Everybody's from heaven, you know. All these thoughts and feelings are from heaven, but it ain't so. So how much is there dominion? Because I think about the way that God works. Is God, how pushy is God? I mean, can't you go through your whole life and be happy and fulfilled and not lightning bolt struck and not even believe that God exists, right? So if there really is God, God is so lets us have so much latitude that he doesn't even, like, okay, I'll let you waver on some things, but you just got to know I'm here, right? If there's that much freedom, sort of just put that up next to the characteristics of these thoughts and feelings. Like, how pushy are they? Does that make sense, what I'm saying? That's the first sort of screen test you can run, is this thing trying to dominate you in that way? That's a thought that I had. Okay. Before we get to the main example, I want to go on a tangent, which is, this is like obscure, it shouldn't be in here, but Swedenborg talks about how angelic thought and feeling is abstract from persons. Have you guys ever heard of that? I'll read a
number on it, so you will have heard of it. This is from Secrets of Heaven, Arcana Celestia 8343. Hence it is said that the falsities of faith and evils of life cast themselves into hell. And therefore, when the angels are thinking and speaking about the hells, they think and speak of falsities and evils abstractly from those who are there. For the angels always remove ideas of persons and remain in ideas of things. So that's strange. So you're not thinking about all these people that do these bad things. You're thinking about bad things. That kind of mindset, that kind of drive, that's what makes hell. Not that this group of people makes that. And again, Secrets of Heaven 5225. The reason of this is that in the spiritual world or in heaven, not persons but things come into view. For persons limit the idea and concentrate it upon something finite, whereas things do not limit and concentrate it, but extend to the infinite and thus the Lord. So there's a million of those. And I don't know what it means, really, but it makes me think of, do you know that saying, great minds discuss ideas? Whatever he says, middle-sized minds discuss events, small minds discuss people. There might be something useful in there. That if your thoughts are so focused on yourself as a person, other people as a person, who's doing what, what's this kind of thing, is that a little red flag that, like, this might not be from the heavenliest heaven ever? And I don't say this as, like, this is guilt. You guys shouldn't think like this, but I think about us being relatively trapped by negative emotions and negative thoughts. So these are little keys that may pop up at some time to give you a little breathing room. So that was all the intro, so here's the real talk. I want to talk about the major, how do you know what's on your side and what's not on your side in thoughts and feelings? Let's talk about the major categories of fear in life. And where does heaven and hell show up on either sides of those? I would think that if we're talking about sort of the major worries of life, one would be that we go through, do I have friends? Like, am I loved? You know, am I valued? And that shows up in different forms. You know, when you're looking for a social scene, when you're a teenager, it's one form, but then, am I respected in the community? Am I going to fit in somewhere? Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, that's sort of a major category of worry that I've found people in. You know, you talk to people, often there's a worry surrounding that. What I'm gonna posit is that these major categories, if there's a worry in one of them, that may be that's coming at you from hell, because if you read Swedenborg's description of the eternal life, all these problems, we're not actually in any danger surrounding all of them. And what I mean, it's very unclear, but maybe this will make it clear. Heaven and hell, 44. Kindred souls gravitate toward each other spontaneously, as it were. For with each other, they feel as though they are with their own family at home. When they are with kindred souls, they enjoy the fullest freedom and find life totally delightful. What that's part of a larger teaching he has, that in the afterlife, you are with your buddies, right? That you come into community with people that you are like soul friends with. That everybody is destined to be around, be completely loved and respected and around people that they really love, right? And that's like a foundational piece of heaven. So if that's the view from 10,000 feet, you know, God sees all time
as one. If that's the view from 10,000 feet, is God telling you, you better worry about whether or not you have enough friends? Or you better worry about whether or not people like you, right? So what I'm trying to do is, these are the major categories of fear, and this is why I think if you're getting fear around those categories, that's hell trying to bother you, right? Does that make sense? Okay. That was the first category. I find that another category is romantic fear. Like, am I going to, if you don't have a partner, am I going to find a partner? If you have a partner, is this the right partner? Are we going to get to stay together? And infinite variations on that, right? So that's a fear. But what this I guess Swedenborg doesn't really say anything about that in the afterlife, right? Just kidding. There's this whole book that he wrote that is called Married Love or Conjugal Love, and there's all kinds of weird stuff in it. But the point is there's this huge focal point of life is that even if you go through some rocky patches here, you're going to end up in just the coolest relationship of all time, right? That's not just a side note. This is part of your birthright. You know, is that you're going to have that. So that if that's the view from 10,000 feet, that all angels know that, God knows that. They see that that's coming down the pike. Don't worry, you're getting prepped for it in the way. It's going to be fine. So everyone who's saying you better worry about that, and that's not heaven. Would heaven talk like that? I mean, you'd have to be really out of the loop, like. Morty, you didn't get the memo that the people end up happy in this area. So heaven's not going to try to make you worry about that. Do you see what I'm trying to say? How do you know what's heaven or hell? Because it's one thing to say, I know, I know that I shouldn't try to steal from people. It's a different experience, like, what's going to happen to me romantically? And like that's a different experience. So I'm trying to say, how do you know where's heaven and hell when somebody just dumped you? Or how do you know where's heaven and hell when you feel like, oh, I'm getting older, I'm not going to find anybody? How, you know, is there going to be a place for me? Where's heaven and hell there? And so what I'm saying is, hell is saying, be worried about this. Heaven is saying, don't worry about it. And like I said in the first number, if we can just introduce that concept, oh, these worries, that's hell, that's when angels can alleviate it. And I have found this to work in small ways. That even if you have a thought or feeling come in and you just say, that's not mine or that's not something I need to value, you do feel different about it than if you grabbed it and ruminated on it and made it a part of your life. And, you know, that's the best technique that I've found. Very quickly, two last sort of categories of fear that I feel like people have. Your value, your existential value in terms of occupation, which doesn't sound very emotional, but am I good at anything? Like, do I have anything value to contribute to society? Yeah, don't we worry about that? Am I good? I have a job. Am I any good at my job? Like, right now, this is not my job, but I'm talking to you guys. And I'm giving, like, a sort of a confusing, strange talk. So it's like, but it doesn't matter because this is what I really think is important information to get. So if you can take away one or two things and it will help you when you're actually in the field, like, oh, I'm feeling afraid. I'm feeling hurt about this thing. Wait, maybe this is from hell. Then that's fine. You know, that's why we're here. So there's that worry about your value in that way. But then again, in the Swedenborgian view of the afterlife, there's a quote that says the very heart of providence, though, is that we should be in some particular place in heaven. Or some particular place in the divine heavenly person and therefore in the Lord. This is what happens for the people for whom the Lord can lead to heaven. Since the Lord foresees this, he also constantly provides for it, with the result that all of us who are willing allow ourselves to be led to heaven and are being prepared for our own places in heaven. So there's a spot for you. How much of life is this fear that like there's not really a place for me? But there is. And not only is there, but that's the constant effort of providence. Is to put you there. So if that's what God is doing, like today, God is waking up and, okay, what's on my schedule? Prepare this person for their eternal perfect fit place for them. If you get thoughts and feelings that are making you worry about your fit, your value as a person, your like right to membership in the human race, God's not saying that, right? So that, to me, can, once I've categorized it like that, then I potentially have the ability to say, well, that's from hell. And then you change the way you relate to those thoughts and feelings. Just saying. just saying, man. Yeah. Another way, it's all about trying to identify where's heaven, where's hell. Another way that you could try to do that is what I would call like the wind and the sea, or the wind and the waves. I'm going to read a quote from Mark. This is 4:35 to 41. On the same day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us cross over to the other side." Now when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was. And other little boats were also with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on a pillow. And they woke him and said, "Teacher, do you not care that we're perishing?" Then he arose and rebuked the wind and said to them, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. But he said to them, "Why are you so fearful? How is it you have no faith?" And they feared exceedingly and said to one another, "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" So the wind and the sea is this stuff. I mean, this is the sea and the wind. You know, the stuff that's trying to buffet us around and mess with us. So in this story, they notice how the wind and the sea behave, and they say, "Who's this?" Like, we're going to try to identify Jesus through how he can affect the wind and the sea. So let's reverse it. We know Jesus. Jesus is divine truth, right? I mean, and so based on knowing him, how do the things in our mind react? And if they lie flat when we introduce divine truth, maybe they were just the wind and the sea in the first place. So we'll give some examples. There's a story of Jesus in the wilderness. You guys know that story. He gets tempted by the devil. And they kind of engage in this little verbal spar where the devil says, "Why don't you do this?" And Jesus quotes a little line of scripture back. And that's how it plays out. You know, make the stones into bread. I've found that the best psychological tool that I'm working with currently is short repetitions of scripture. You got to find out what, if you get an attacking thought and feeling, how does it react when God shows up in the form of divine truth? I'm having some kind of angst about some issue, right? If I say something, you know, like I'll say care for the morrow, you know, which is, this is from Swedenborg, where he's this whole line of this whole passage about divine providence and how divine providence is working so that you know, it's going to take care of you eternally, and people who are in the stream of providence, even though they know that tomorrow's going to happen, they're not worried about it because they know that everything that happens in life, every little minutia, is coming to good in the end. So they don't have care for tomorrow. So when I say that little phrase, it means you, thought and feeling that are trying to make me worry about something here. You are in violation of international law. Because care for the morrow, that's against divine law, right? What are you doing? You know, I don't know exactly what you are, where you're from, but that's a bad start. Like if you're driving across the border into Canada, if your car looks a certain way, it's just a bad start, you know? So care for the morrow is one of those. I would say you got to find different phrases that address different things. Sometimes I will get worries like, yeah, how will your life turn out, Curtis? Will you have, like, the impact that you're supposed to have? Will you get, you know, experience the things you're supposed to experience? Will you, will you do good, a good job in life? And I have a little phrase that I use for that, which is, I hope the Lord will use me as his best for everyone. And that was, it's not from the Bible, it's not from Swedenborg, but it encapsulates those things. It was actually said by my grandfather. This was very, very soon before he died. He was sick, he was in the hospital. I didn't meet him, but I was told about it. And I think it was my grandma or something was, you know, when are you going to die? Or somehow that was coming up, and he said, I hope the Lord will use me as his best for everyone. That mindset is impervious to hell. Hell is all based on trying to get you to worry about how well you're going to do. You know, if you're saying, I hope the Lord will use me as best for everyone, it sucks the air out of the room. You know, they came with their, like, salesman suits on, like, we got a great worry plan here for you. We're gonna kind of take these issues and over the course of years work them deeper and deeper into your psyche so that they pretty much become a part of who you are, and we're gonna build on them and try. You know, they can't sell, like, oh, we're selling boats. Oh, you don't live by a lake. You know, you take yourself out of the equation. So what I would say is find, those are my phrases. You know, there's a lot of them that I use. Speak the word, but it will not stand. That's from the Bible. The axe is laid at the root of the tree. If I'm really, like, in the thick of it, I'll say that one. The repetition of these phrases you can notice how does it make the thoughts and feelings behave. And I also, it's also in a way, it's like two things. It's like I'm rubber and you're glue. Do you guys know that? This is like the defense mechanism, or used to be, for kids. Somebody says something to you, and you'll just say, like, I'm rubber, you're glue, bounces off me and sticks to you, and you just repeat that. And what effect does that have? You're not the same kind of target anymore, because your bullies are trying to get a rise out of you, and if that's all they're going to get, the game is less worth playing. So these thoughts and feelings, I'm talking about worries and anxious thoughts or whatever else it is, guilt, whatever you're dealing with, it wants you to start a conversation. I have found this through a lot of research. I spent years in those conversations. It wants you to start a conversation. If you can stop the conversation before it happens with one of these phrases, that is a better way to spend your day. And you begin to have instead the thoughts and feelings that are actually new and constructive. So if you're there with the I'm rubber, you're glue, also it's sort of like saying, don't talk to me about it, talk to God. Like, I'm the secretary. I'm not in charge of whether or not I'm a worthwhile person. That you wouldn't talk to God about that. That's what these little phrases are. And you find that once they don't have the leverage there, it changes. You don't get stuck in the same sort of loops. So that's my secret sauce. I mean, just try it. You know, if you find what works for you, and make it specific to the categories. You know, you can't just have one phrase that you always say. It'll lose some of its power. You want to find out what specifically are they trying to get. Is it trying to get you to worry about the future? And your value or something, then that's care for the morrow. But is it trying to stir up negative feelings towards someone else? Love your neighbor as yourself. You know, find the more you can find the direct antidote to it, the more power it has. And the more you can rotate, because they're going to rotate, come at you in different ways. The more if it's just one thing, it'll get worn down. So find eight, find five. And have those, and identify the correct cat. Because the more closely your little stone fits with the challenge, the more effective it is. That's what I find. So there's that. And I do want to. I will take look if we have questions, because I know this is relatively obscure, but we can get. But I want to talk about. The angels that ministered to Jesus. I was just doing a show about it. You know how in the wilderness, I was telling you that the devil tempted Jesus. And angels came and ministered to him. Do you know that part? It said just at the end, the devil takes him up on a high mountain, takes him up on the tower. At the end, it says angels came and ministered to Jesus. And looking at the internal sense of that, the angels stand for divine truths. It's not actually angels. It's these truths that came and ministered, which might sound less comforting and strange, but there's sort of a blurry line between what each are. But what I take away from that is when you're in the wilderness, meaning, you know, it looks different for everybody, but there are these states of mind, right, that are miserable, right? When you're in various kinds of misery, what I've found is what ministers to you are these these are eternal sort of truths. What does that mean? That means things that are independent of time and space. When I try to, like I've said before, when I try to come at, when I try to come at worries or fears or negative thoughts and feelings with something that's on the same time scale as them, like, you know, you just made this speech to these guys at this thing and nobody liked it. If I say, some people liked it, or I made other speeches that people liked, you know, you're not going to win that way. That's exactly what they want. Like, okay, you want to have a conversation about this? Okay, well, what about that one time? Do you remember this time? It was 3 years ago. You were doing that. Do you remember that? And then you get this sucking feeling, and that's when it, you know, just like an emotional, like a little adrenaline, and then you're done, man. But instead, you say, I hope the Lord will use me as best for everyone. That's an eternal truth. That is a totally different response. And it reminds you, suddenly, oh yeah, I remember all these things, these sort of higher truths that I believe about life, which aren't always with you in the trenches. You sort of think they are, but they're just outside your peripheral vision then. And I get sucked into things, and then I'll suddenly remember, oh yeah, there's this whole bigger world about we all love each other, and we're all like flawed and learning and changing and trying to make it through, and there's this divine goodness, and there's this eternal awesome future that we can be headed towards. But you don't have that always. You know, it's not always there. So I find these little phrases are the way that you remind yourself that that's true. You know? So those are, that in general is the best ways that I've found to identify what is heaven and hell, because everything is so specific to your own life. And I remember I once did this project where I know that on Wednesday some of you guys watched a video that I made called Head Bullies. And this was a similar sort of topic. At one point, I went around and I started interviewing people about what were their head bullies, you know? What was getting them down? And it was just, I guess, the people that came to me had something really getting at them. But people have very different things that are chewing them apart, but the things that are chewing them apart behave in very similar ways. You know, I had, you know, talked to somebody who was, it was all family issues. You know, they were all wrapped up in that. Like, that was like their heaviest weight to them. There was somebody else who it was something she had done 3 years ago, and it was like pure guilt surrounding that. And everybody she saw, if she would see an expression in their face that she didn't recognize, she's like, they know what I did, and they hate me for it. You know, and that was all plastered all over all of her experience all the time. There are people who they're entirely consumed with being with body image. You know, that this is the only thing that their value is entirely tied into that. You know, it's all different things, but it all sort of functions in a similar way. That if you said it to them, they're all it's their thing, but it's different for everyone. But it will act in similar ways. So how do you, with something that diverse, and I think that's hell. I mean, that's how hell shows up in a mind. So how do you create a system where you can know what the heck we're looking at? So this is my best guess at that system. And I think I'd like to develop something better and better. But generally, we can know generalities, and from that, create enough reasonable doubt that a jury of 12 people would convict this thing as, this is not coming from God. God is not telling you to be wrapped up in this. You know, God is saying, be happy, be free, keep learning, be humble. You know, so that's what I want to say about it. So that's my raw material, and you guys can take it and improve on it. And it's always interesting to hear some people are already using little phrases. Some people have, it's interesting to hear how people use their spiritual tools to pull themselves up and out. So we have a little bit of time here. What I would love to do, if you guys are interested, is either we can talk, have questions about that, what I really want to know is, what are your spiritual tools? What do you guys do to help kind of lift yourself out, you know? So, does anybody have one? Yeah.
I applaud you because you appeal to the young people. And your way, you can get through to them. And rather than, you know, preaching and stuff. And I really believe that you help a lot of young people. So I think you're doing the Lord's work.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Evelyn.
Thanks.
Evelyn Bousquet. And some of the things I do, I believe there's many paths to God. And you have to find your path where you feel comfortable. Sometimes I use affirmations. I'll borrow from things that I've read. I could have peace instead of this if I'm thinking of a negative thought.
Yeah.
And recognizing that you have a negative thought is very important. Because a lot of people just let them come and don't realize they're thinking negative. If I have a problem that I'm working on, I will read John 14 to 17 for 21 days.
Yeah.
And that increases my my inspiration and makes me feel better. Thank you.
Awesome.
Susanna Curry, well, for phrases, and I want to just lift up that it was so helpful for you to mention, you know, switching them up, because I, for judgment, when that comes in my head, I just always say, who am I to know how the Lord is working in other people's lives?
Yeah.
And that takes it right away, because I don't know, and it's up to the Lord. So I'm going to work on my repertoire because I need to expand it a little bit.
Yeah.
And specify. I think that's another thing that was really helpful that you said about specifying it to the situation. Because and that gets back to the one of the passages you read in the beginning about how angels think in the generalities. They don't ascribe these details. If you're getting the real detailed thought out, you should be really upset about this thing this person said. That's never an angel.
Yeah.
It's never an angel telling you that because they're just pouring the love on, pouring the compassion on, and you know that's how we're kept in freedom, is that the angels are never compulsive.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for
Absolutely.
All the great tips in that.
Yeah. And with judgment, you know that line, if I will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Like, I like that one for that. It's Jesus just telling one of the disciples, like, don't worry what this other one's doing. You follow me. So I repeat that to myself. If it's like, what about what this person is doing? Either like, this person is doing something that's bad, or this person is better than you. Or so absolutely. Yes.
George McCurdy. When you were talking about the Lord and the disciples in the boat, I don't know why, but the word insouciant came to mind. The definition of insouciant: nonchalant, untroubled, unworried, unruffled, unconnected, indifferent, blasé, and heedlessly careless. Well, you know what? I'm in that boat, and there's times that I am insouciant as to what the plan is. But I do want to be unruffled. I do want to not get myself overly troubled about, I got to make, you know, I want to, so that word suddenly, insouciant, took on a little bit of a positive meaning to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to run ahead of the Lord. I want to run maybe slightly behind him with him leading me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just don't want to feel like I've got to have all the answers. You know, being a minister, people will say, well, what are those writings? And sometimes my mind is as blank as as to what's... So, yeah, I am insouciant, but I'm not going to let that word be a negative for me anymore. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very cool.
And my wife said she wants the microphone next.
Okay.
Lois McCurdy, you asked about what things help us through difficult times. And one thing that happens is if something happens in the world that isn't happening the way that I think it should, I always think the Lord's going to bring good out of everything. That truth helps a lot. The other truth is the idea of real peace, that people in the world may think that peace is if you don't have any bills or any things that you have to, time constraints that you have to do, that would be peaceful. Ah, but I learned from the writings that peace is trust in providence, and that helps a great deal to bring peace.
Somebody else?
Yeah. Guard Perry. So, hey, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Really wonderful. Yeah, very. So you reminded me of a couple things and sort of encouraged me and perhaps some others to know that the teachings have a very important day-to-day psychological, mental health, emotional capacity. So yeah. I'm thinking of two writers that have, among others, that have been influential in the Swedenborgian Church, Wilson Van Dusen, mm-hmm. who talked about angels either as angels or as psychological states, and that either way, they're real. So you've encouraged us to realize that our thoughts are real.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the first one. The second one is the work that Peter Rhodes did with mm-hmm. Proprium in his book, AIM.
Yeah.
And you made a move in a couple of places in your talk that reminded me, and I'm so happy to be reminded of the move he makes, which is to say that the proprium, which is our experience of ourself being drawn down, perhaps. I'm thinking of that part of our proprium. Mm-hmm. He said, call it it.
Yeah.
And there's a psychological distance that's then created. And you did that during your talk a couple times. You talked to the it.
Yeah.
I believe.
Yep.
If you'd be willing to maybe reflect on that move a little bit, I'd be happy.
Yeah. The language that you put on things has a huge impact. If you notice how politics are conducted, both sides are trying to name an issue in a way that supports them, and that often the naming of the issue, what you put on it, is it like, you know, is it clean coal or is it dirty something? You know, the way that you name it really affects how people perceive it. So to do something like to say, oh, it's trying to get me to do this, instead of you're just in the thoughts and feelings, that is the difference. That is the things that in the beginning quote from Swedenborg, that gives the angels a crack to get in there and push that thing out. So yeah, I think absolutely.
I think that's really huge. I've known it, and yet I think you've articulated a practice where, as you went back from your beginning, a thought seems to be ours. And I like to be as sane as the next person, and I'm going to say, and yeah, it is mine. Of course it is. But the contra-intuitive insight is that, well, wait a minute. No, it's not. It's not ours. It's actually coming into us. And whether you think of it as a psychological state, we don't know where those come from either. We know they come from the brain, maybe, but we don't know exactly how. Well, Swedenborg says they come from heaven or hell. And so that distance of saying, okay, it's not mine, it's coming in, so what is, and then there's an it, the thought becomes an it, and there's a dialogue. Yeah. I think that psychological space is critical.
Yeah.
And I think you've demonstrated some of that. So I want to make sure I lift that up as helpful.
Also hold the mic. Garner, if you hand it to me, I'll run it back.
Okay.
Thank you.
That there's as much, that, you know, having thoughts is one thing, and how we react to them is just as much a part of who we are, you know?
Hi, Shada Sullivan. I really appreciated your point about how Swedenborg makes it seem very black and white, but in application it can become more difficult, and therefore you've created all these categories that help with sorting and discerning, because it really does all seem like us, and how do we create distance between the right thoughts and let in the right thoughts? And so I'm thinking again about your story from Mark and the waves in the sea, and what happens when you apply divine truth to something. And I'm wondering if it's a helpful way to discern what we really should listen to. If we're getting churned up and we apply a divine truth to it, as you suggest, and it does, as you say, become still because they can't argue with it, then we know that that's from hell. But if we try to apply a divine truth to it and we're still choppy, does that perhaps mean that that is something we need to pay attention to?
Yeah, the answer is I don't know. But so I won't, it won't, you know, you want to give it like a, in my experience, give it the college try for quite a while. I mean, stuff can be pretty, and look, sort of look for micro releases, and is the general current, when you come in with those, with that divine truth and love, are they flowing against each other? Even if the other one, you just start to get a picture of who's fighting who, you know. If so, I don't know. As far as, like, there certainly are issues that you have to deal with, and how, where does that line go? I don't know. But like what I was saying at the beginning of the talk, is life harder than it needs to be? It's not like we're going to be able to apply these and there's never going to be any sadness or fear or pain. That's not the point. The point is the chronic stuff that's unnecessarily there. So I don't, it's a, that you're asking the question I'm asking. So whatever you find, let me know. Yeah, someone behind you, I think. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Red Wing Wilderbrook. I just wanted to share a tool that I learned from a program that I went to. When I'm going through troubled times and I find myself kind of consumed with thoughts and feelings, one of the first things I go to is what I call distract and soothe. Because if my mind is like roiled up in a storm, something as simple as reading a book or watching a movie or going for a walk, if you can come up with a whole list of things that just get you out of your head, you know, get you out of your troubled mind, that really helps. And then soothing things that you know that soothe you, like taking a warm shower, you know, meditating, I mean, just a whole host of things. So it's funny because in my mind, if I realize I'm getting upset about something, I think DNS, time for DNS.
Yeah.
Distract and soothe.
That's perfect. And maybe even like writing it down, because I'd probably like, oh, I should have distracted and soothed instead of spending all day, like, you know, like even having it there in front
right.
of you.
Right.
Yeah, because it's so easy to forget everything. You seem to have that one down, but for the rest of us. Yeah. Thanks.
This is Trevor. I have two comments. One is that when I was a teenager, I learned this principle from someone else, and I used it in a non-religious context. Something that constantly bugs me is the song stuck in my head. And it's constant. There's always a song in my head, and sometimes it's the same song for days and days and days. But all I have to do is sing Hey Jude, take a sad song and make it better, and it goes away.
Yeah.
And it works, and it works really well. And another thing that works is the saying, the phrase really works for people that sound is really important, but for visual people, all you have to do is take out your imaginary camera and go, click, gotcha.
Yeah.
And it works. And they're like, what? Flashbulb on.
Yeah, don't tag
and
me.
And they
on
go
Facebook.
Away. And we have time for about one more question.
Okay.
I was going to say, I've heard that called an earworm. You can give them to people by singing a song and then it gets stuck in their mind. But, yeah. Anyone else?
All right. We think we're wrapping up, right?
Yep.
Thanks, everybody.